From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our relationships with it. I'm Chris Cherniak.
And I'm Claire Wiley. And this morning, we first speak with renowned climate scientist Dr. Jagadish Shukla, who comes on to discuss his new book, A Billion Butterflies, A Life in Climate and Chaos Theory, an inspiring and informative memoir.
That's in the first part of the show. Then in the second part, we speak with naturalist and photographer Charles Hood, who captures nocturnal adventures all over the world in his new book, Nature at Night, Discover the Hidden World That Comes Alive After Dark. While most tales may warn us about the dangers that lie waiting in the dark, there's actually an abundance of thriving, colorful, and even adorable, Claire's words.
That's my words.
creatures that live their best lives under the moon and stars. Charles Hood and his new book, Nature at Night, in the second part of the show. Environmental awareness and education, that's what This Green Earth is all about. Stay with us. Joining us in the first part of the show is Dr. Jagadish Shukla. He's here to talk about his experiences and life and career as a climate scientist and his new book titled A Billion Butterflies, A Life in Climate and Chaos Theory. Dr. Shukla, thank you so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
Thank you.
We always like to start at the beginning and get a little background on our guests and how they came into the world of the environmental field in one way or another. You grew up in India in the 40s and 50s. How did you first become interested in weather and climate? Was it as a boy?
Well, thank you for this opportunity, by the way, to explain to you. You know, my origin story and the origin of the book are actually connected. As you mentioned, I was born in a very small village in North India, which has no schools or roads, no light, except kerosene lamps, and I walked barefoot till up to 12. But my father was determined that I should study science. So the things that I remember from that childhood in the village was three things. One is that we're all very poor, and my family was a little better than many others. But whenever there will be a monsoon drought, monsoons are the rainy season in India, June, July, August, September, the entire agriculture depends upon it, and it will be devastated. The whole village will go hungry many times. And the other thing I learned is from my mother, is that we should really try to help people who really are not as privileged as we are. So I actually came up with like two or three impressions which have guided most of the things in the future, including the book. And I'll tell you very quickly. One is, again, what I learned from my mother is that we should really try to help people. Then I say, how can I help my village? I said, the best thing I can do is predict monsoon. Because monsoon rainfall, their life depends upon it. I had some knowledge of meteorology, but I had this desire that I think we should try to help people. And then by a whole bunch of good luck and serendipity and jumping many steps, I ended up in MIT and Princeton and ended up doing a PhD on two of the top scientists in the world who work on weather prediction and predictability. But my problem at MIT was that the person who is considered to be the father of butterfly effect is a professor there, that you cannot predict beyond 10 days. My whole goal was to predict seasonal mean, monsoon rainfall. So I made that sort of the goal. And then, that involves modeling, weather prediction, climate prediction, coming up with a hypothesis, testing the hypothesis. Finally, I could show that climate is predictable. So how is this related to the billion butterflies?
Right.
The whole butterfly effect is related to that the weather, if you perturb the today's weather just a little bit, as little as wings of a butterfly when it flies, you cannot predict after 10 days. And that's the property of those equations. And I try to show that you know, forget about one butterfly. Use billions of butterflies, and still you can predict the climate. So in order to prove that point, I basically showed that if the ocean temperature is known, seasonal mean can be predicted, particularly for the monsoon and tropical atmosphere. So that's really the origin of the book, this desire to sort of solve. And the reason it says climate and chaos is because obviously the book will show how much chaotic my life was. Still, I never gave up about the sort of attempt to do something. And the goal was simply to show that there is a lot of predictability. You know, the butterfly effect gives a kind of negative impression as if things are not predictable, there's right. so much chaos. I have a different point of view. I really think that there's a lot of order, there's a lot of predictability in the midst of chaos. And we just have to emphasize and find them. That's what I did for seasonal mean rainfall over India.
Wow. So you went to MIT probably as a brash young student and kind of pushed back on this theory of chaos theory, the butterfly effect. But so how was that initially received? I mean,
That's a very good question. First of all, the guru, my main guru, who is the world expert, he said, oh, that's a good work. But at that time, in the whole world, there are very few people who are willing to believe that things are really predictable beyond 10 days.
Right.
And then eventually I published my paper in Science, which is called Predictability in the Midst of Chaos. And I just go everywhere and slowly it caught on. And now, believe it or not, there are many places in the world which are doing seasonal prediction routinely. Mm. They're not very accurate simply because we don't know, the models are not good, and the boundary conditions like ocean temperature, we cannot predict because the prediction depends upon the ocean temperature. Mm. But see, this is the thing in science and in any field, I think. If you have an idea, you just have to pursue. Don't give up. Eventually, that idea was responsible for me creating a major center called Center for Ocean Land Atmosphere. Many scientists, the entire center now has formed a whole new department at the George Mason University. And it is being done, and as a matter of fact, the groups, scientific groups, are now trying to prove what about beyond season, what about decadal variability. And just to make sure that there's no confusion between climate prediction and seasonal and decadal prediction, these are very different problems. Climate prediction is easy and quite predictable. All we need to know is that how much CO2 the humans will inject in the atmosphere, or how many trees we'll cut.
Right.
That's what the climate depends upon, or how many volcanoes will be there. But of course, we cannot predict that. So there's some unpredictability. And therefore, you have many, many models in the world which have correctly predicted that global temperature will increase. You know, the increase of global temperature was predicted 40 years ago by one of my gurus at MIT, Jules Cherney, because National Academy has a meeting. So I just wanted to make it clear that the problem of weather prediction was handled, you know, more like 70, 80 years ago, again, by Charney and von Neumann. And you create these big models with billions of equations and supercomputers. So, you know, the weather that you watch on TV came out of a supercomputer which solved billions of equations. And not to get the weather from today to tomorrow, from weather from today to 3 minutes later. Then from that, another 3 minutes. Then another 3 minutes. Yeah. That's how we get our 24-hour forecast. Right. And it's getting much better, as you must have noticed. The weather forecast is getting much better.
Yes.
In this. And it has really, you know, revolutionized. This is one of the, this idea that you can use mathematical equations and supercomputers to predict weather. The big limitation is that the weather tomorrow completely depends upon weather today. But we don't know the weather today exactly everywhere on the world.
Right.
On the globe. That's one of the big problems, in addition to the fact that the equations don't allow it.
Right.
I want to get into a foundational thing that you do with your students, and you ask them a seemingly simple question, and you go so much deeper, and you ask them why it gets cold at night.
There is this misunderstanding. So let me just be clear. We're not talking about the kind of climate. So I was trying to explain. People think, oh, climate is very complicated. And especially people who don't really want to believe in the reality of human-induced climate change, they just say, oh, climate's so complicated. I don't want to talk about it. I don't know why it is happening. That's totally false. Climate is very easy to understand. And it is as easy as understanding why it gets cold at night. So that's why I ask the students why it gets cold at night. And they all raise their hands. And they say, sunset, there's no sun, it is not heating. And then I ask the next student, everybody, yes, 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 that's a good answer. Then I told them that, look, for that answer in my class, you will get a B or B minus. Now, probably you are surprised too, because many people think that is the answer.
Right.
That actually half of the answer, and not the most interesting half. So let me explain to you and to the listeners, because if there's one thing I want the audience to go with, is that climate science to climate change is easy. It's the climate policy which is complicated, right. And we're not talking about it right now. But the reason it gets cold at night is because Earth is losing energy all the 24 hours a day, all the time. And over a year, Earth loses as much energy to space that we gain from sun. In fact, there is a temperature at which both energies are equal. That temperature is called climate. So when we say our global temperature is 15 degrees centigrade now at the surface, that is the temperature at which all the energy coming from sun is equal to all the energy leaving Earth over 1 year. And it depends upon how much CO2 is in the atmosphere. See, till 100 years ago, that temperature was 14 degrees. Now it has become 15 degrees, okay? Because we have increased the CO2. It's very easy. Venus is closer to the sun, but the temperature at which the both energies are equal is close to 600 degrees. Simple reason. One reason is, of course, it's close to the sun, but that's not the main reason. The entire atmosphere of Venus is carbon dioxide. So the fact that carbon dioxide increase is the one that is responsible for climate change is absolutely no doubt about it, okay? Right. Unless people who don't want to believe it will not believe it. And the very fact that at night it gets colder shows you that Earth is losing energy. And the only reason it is warm during the daytime is because that cooling is compensated by the sun's energy. But there's nothing to compensate. So it is this delicate balance that determines the climate. And by perturbing that balance, by putting more CO2 or cutting more forests, we're creating an imbalance. That's why the temperature is going up. That is the reason I start my class with explaining that climate change, climate is a very delicate balance. I just said at the beginning to you, the weather tomorrow completely depends upon the weather today. So that's why we are not able to predict exactly what will happen to weather 5-10 days, 15 days, 20 days. But what will happen at 100 years mean, annual mean, we can tell you with a lot more confidence if we know the CO2. And you must have seen in all the climate change report, they always say the IPCC, you know, Intergovernmental Panel on right. Climate Change, comes out with these reports. I was a member of one of those.
Right.
And says, here's the uncertainty. Why they say that uncertainty? Because all the models, because we don't know what the CO2 will be. We cannot predict our society. We cannot predict our energy consumption. So it is this very fundamental property of carbon dioxide, which I hope the listeners will remember, is that the amount of solar energy that comes to the Earth, CO2, carbon dioxide, doesn't care. It's not affected. But the energy that goes out is stopped by carbon dioxide. So that's why it is called the carbon dioxide has a greenhouse effect.
Right.
It almost acts like a greenhouse. That's why our temperatures are going up.
If you just joined us, we're speaking with Dr. Jagadish Shukla. He is a professor of climate dynamics at George Mason University and the author of the new book, A Billion Butterflies, A Life in Climate and Chaos Theory. Well, speaking of climate change and those climate assessment reports and the IPCC, we're about 25, almost 30 years now of climate assessments and reporting done by the IPCC and other groups like that. Going back 30 years ago, Dr. Shukla, imagine thinking ahead to 2025 and you said, well, if we do, if it's business as usual, we're going to be here, XYZ, at 2025. Well, here it is, 2025. Are things, I guess, say, worse or better than you may have predicted some 30 or 40 years ago with respect to climate?
Things are slightly worse, let me tell you. They are perfectly within the range that was predicted.
Yep.
And that assessment started 25 years ago, but there is an assessment that was done by a very distinguished group of U.S. scientists by National Academy of Sciences. That was 42 years ago.
Mm.
Exactly the same conclusion. They didn't have as sophisticated models as we have. And it's not only worse, but it is getting worse.
Yes.
It is just getting worse, and all the manifestations of climate change, which we were afraid, have already started happening.
Yeah.
In a way which is worse than we had expected. So it's a very, very sort of precarious situation that we know the science, we know what will happen, we had predicted it, it is happening, but governments, especially like our government, simply say, no, we don't care. We will continue. Let's burn coal. And I tell you, as a scientist, I don't know how policies are made, but as a scientist, I'm absolutely flabbergasted because all these people who make policies, they also have children, right?
Right.
They have grandchildren. You'll see. I dedicated my book to my three grandchildren, and I said, they are the one who will feel the brunt of the climate change, and hopefully they will adapt to it.
Right, and to your point, the White House just last week or so canceled the further preparation of the next National Climate Assessment Report.
I tell you, I can't even think about what is going on.
Yes.
Okay, I talked about chaos in my book.
Yeah.
But this book was written before January of 2025, much before, okay? We don't even know how to describe what is going on. What will, so that's you have to get a real expert on that topic.
That's
but
its own.
All I can tell you is that we are having a huge problem now convincing students that climate is an area to work on.
Hmm.
I mean, thanks God, there are countries like, you know, there are areas, European countries and even China, they really are fully committed to take care of it too. Because in the end, we really have to reduce the emissions.
Right.
And I do want to get back to that point of how, in respect to different areas, when you can predict a monsoon or predict these weather patterns, how you can save lives, how you can help people with how they are planting or getting their food sources. How does that play into effect, and why was that so important for you? Because you had alluded to that being one of the main impetuses of you doing this in general.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think you just said that. Let me just repeat, in fact, what you said. After we learned how to predict seasonal averages, seasonal rainfall, not everywhere in the world, but those areas where the seasonal rainfall is very much affected by ocean temperature, like El Nino, and phenomena like that, are even big change in the soil moisture. They have now completely new practices, agriculture practices. There is an international center in New York, International Research Institute for Climate Prediction. They just produce, and all over the world, countries use these forecasts to advise the farmers. And every region of Asia has developed their own sort of groups. They get together, they go over these forecasts. So this has made a real impact, but I want to make sure that they are not perfect forecasts, but they are just so much better because we never had anything based on mathematical equations and models before, okay, which is much, we can also not only predict, we can also estimate reliability, how good it is, or how much it is reliable in this. So it has definitely made a big impact, particularly in the developing countries.
Right. And here in the U.S., for example, it's tornado season, let's say, in the Midwest Southeast. And so great advancements in satellite technology and computer modeling has now enabled forecasters to go live stream on YouTube and watch these storms developing in real time and warning people of pretending tornadoes or hailstorms or other damaging weather events.
Absolutely. See, the ability to observe nature in real time, all this technology has really changed the way we actually inform people. But I have to tell you, as a scientist, no matter how good pictures you have of what is happening today, to predict what will happen 6 hours later, pictures are only of limited value. That's where you need science. That's where you need very complex mathematical equations and supercomputers. Having said that, by the way, I should also add to you that in the last 2 years, our whole mathematical equation and supercomputer idea has been turned upside down by artificial intelligence.
Right.
And they are beginning to make forecasts just as good as our best models. But how do we make it? We do not believe that that's the final solution, because we don't only want to make forecasts, we want to understand how it happened. So it is both the advancement in the observational technology, satellites, radars, aircrafts, ground-based stations, which tell you minute by minute what is happening, and our ability to understand and predict the future, next 3 hours, next 6 hours, next 9 hours, next 1 day, next 10 day, both have gone hand by hand. And that's why it is very disturbing now that now we are cutting on science, that just basically means that our ability to advance knowledge will just stay when we start not paying attention to how we improve the understanding of the weather and climate.
Right. It's an indifference that the consequences are not necessary to us adults, but to our children and our grandchildren. I'll give you the last word. We got to wrap up.
Oh, I totally agree with you. And, I always, whenever I give a lecture, some of the students, young students, they actually say they're getting so much of climate anxiety, what will happen. And my answer to them is, the answer to climate anxiety is climate action. You guys have to let the policymakers know, you guys have to let the institutions know that it's your future, which is being decided by these gray-haired people like me.
Yes. Well, we've got to wrap up.
The book is called A Billion Butterflies, A Life in Climate Chaos. We are talking to Dr. Jagadish Shukla. He has been one of the pioneers in the area of weather predictions, and we appreciate
and
all your work.
And continues to be a pioneer. You're not done yet, Dr. Shukla, right?
Oh, yeah. No. There's a lot more work to be done.
Oh,
yeah.
You bet. We need you.
Yeah, we appreciate you being at the front lines of that. And thank you so much for coming on This Green Earth.
Thank you, Dr. Shukla.
Thank you very much. I love you guys' program.
All right.
This will need a lot of green earth. Yeah.
Yes.
Thank you. Very much.
All right.
And joining us next is naturalist and photographer Charles Hood, who captures nocturnal adventures all over the world. And he, in his new book, does a discovery after dark, Chris. Nature at Night, Discover the Hidden World That Comes Alive After Dark, is his latest read. And while most tales may warn us about the dangers that lie waiting in the dark, there's actually an abundance of thriving, colorful, and these are my words, Charles, adorable creatures that live their best lives under the moon and stars. Thank you for joining us here on This Green Earth.
It's such a great honor to be with you today. Thank you for inviting me.
Absolutely. Let's dive into, first of all, your background and what led you into this field as both a naturalist and a photographer. Was this something as a child that you got into, or was this later in life?
Well, I'm lucky enough to be part of a generation whose parents just let them run wild, I guess is how we talk about it now. You know, as long as you're back by dark and you don't get arrested, things, you know, you're kind of on your own. So I had a bike and a sense of like, well, where can I go on this bike? And that was in Los Angeles. I could go along the LA River. I could go to the LA Zoo and just sort of explore. So to me, nature is not really something to be thought about consciously. It just is. It's just where you go and be. It's where you hang out. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and then why do I take photographs? No one took pictures the way I wanted them to, so I had to take my own.
Oh, well, that's interesting. So you wanted to see the world, or especially maybe these creatures that inhabit it, in a different perspective or way?
Absolutely. I don't know if any of you have had the, again, this is maybe a little more of an age thing, but we used to take pictures at parties where people's eyes were bright red, you know, that the flash was too bright for them. Right. And we have that term, you know, a deer in the headlights. Right. And in this book, Nature at Night, there are no deer in the headlights. It is all subtle, wrapped light. And I actually use the lighting kit that they use for fashion photography, particularly with bats. When I have a handheld bat, even in the rainforest, I'm traveling with some sort of sophisticated diffusing equipment to make the light be softer and more flattering, and hence to make the animals less annoyed by me being there in the first place, and second of all, to look more attractive in the finished image.
Bats, you mentioned, are a nocturnal animal that most of us understand come alive at night, more so just because of probably how they feed. But I'm curious about other, we talk about diurnal animals, and then those animals that come out at dusk and dawn, which is a different type of animal. And then you have these animals that truly come out once everything goes dark. So what are more surprising things that either bloom or start to really live their lives at night?
Well, if we think about being a flower, for example, if I said, just think of some nature, you know, I ask your listeners, just think of nature, or you think of a flower. So you think of something yellow or red and sunlit, maybe a blue sky, maybe a green tree. And that's fine. It's great to be a red flower, but you're competing for pollination with all the other red flowers and yellow flowers out there in the field. So if we ask ourselves as a plant, well, how can I have less competition for my pollination process? Well, I'll come out at night. I'll bloom at night. I need to be white in that case, because red doesn't show up as well, you know, in the night. But something like a saguaro cacti, like if the cactus asks itself, what's a good time to bloom? Night is an especially good time to bloom, because we have different kinds of pollinators that we can have access to, but we don't actually bake our nectar. We don't bake our flowers in the sun. So by being night blooming, the cacti actually get to use the cooler parts of the 24-hour cycle. So all saguaro cacti in Mexico and North America, they're all pollinated by bats that come in like hummingbirds and dip their long nose and their long tongue into the flower, and then they go on to the next flower. So good for the saguaro. They're pretty smart.
Yeah, you just reminded me of one of my favorite flowers too. None other than the night blooming jasmine, which releases such a incredibly
aromatic,
pungent, aromatic scent, which I guess it's designed to draw pollinator species as well?
Sure, and we know that when we're out at night, we don't see quite as well. We are primarily, you know, these vertical primates that we all are.
Yeah.
And so we have to listen with our ears, we have to smell with our nose. So we actually get a different kind of sensation when we're out for a night walk. And jasmine's a great example where you can even smell it, you know, sometimes a block or two away if you're out for an urban walk.
Right.
And that's partly due to the humidity, you know, is often a little bit higher at night, at least here in the American West it is. I'm calling to you from California, but it's also true. Our senses are just a little more alert, and so we're smelling more keenly after dark.
What about marine life? Did you spend time photographing marine life? Because the seas, the oceans, bodies of water are very active at night. What's going on there?
Yeah, let's just fill in our audience. I think you guys have a little better sense of this, but some people, and including for me, it was new. So, okay, we've got phytoplankton. They're in the ocean. They need sunlight. They're the little, basically the sort of the grass of the ocean, or would be very simplistic about it. But phytoplankton need sunlight. So they're up at the surface. They're in the top, you know, 300 feet is pretty much the limit for sunlight reaching water. And things that want to then eat the phytoplankton don't themselves want to be eaten. Yeah. So they spend the daylight down, you know, 1,000 feet, 2,000 feet below the surface. and they come up only at night to feed. And as they come up, then other things are following them, and other things are following them. So that if you want to eat a squid, if you're a dolphin and you like to eat squid, and if you are a dolphin, you have echolocation, so you can feed in the dark. You don't need daylight to feed. So when the squids are coming up to the surface, the dolphins are feeding. For those of you who have been on a whale watching trip and seen, you know, leaping, splashing, frolicking dolphins, they're really having the time of their lives, because the daytime they don't have to feed anymore. If they see a fish, they'll eat it. But they have been feeding all night long. Most species have been feeding all night long.
Right. Okay. So under the cloak of darkness, that's how they get their hunting done. But there's also other biological things going on, like bioluminescence and lots of crazy things that are happening in the marine world at night. Is this something that it's like evolutionary in nature, I guess, the Darwinian in a sense, that these animals had to learn this, like it's safer to be out at night in a sense, like you say, and hide during the day?
Well, some of the things that we are perceiving as nocturnal are perhaps happening all day long, like phosphorescent waves, for example. And it's simply that we perceive them at night. It's not so much that they're more, you know, there's more phosphorescence at night. It's just that that's when we can interact with them. But this vertical migration from the dark to, you know, darker depths of during the day up to the surface at night, this is the largest migration of organisms on the planet. You know, there's nothing compared to, you know, like the Serengeti Plains, I like wildebeest or caribou in Alaska, that's fine. But there's trillions and trillions and trillions of these organisms at night going up and down. And one reason I got interested in it is I had taken a photograph of a leaping dolphin during the daylight, this rough-toothed dolphin. That's kind of a rare tropical species, or rare to me anyway, rare species in Indonesia, and it had these little white corsages of scars down its flanks. And like, what's going on? Those aren't barnacles, and that's not how they mate, you know, how they spar when they're mating. What's going on? And then I began to learn about the cookie cutter sharks.
Yes.
So as things go up and down in the water column, coming up at night to feed and then going back down to hide, there's a small little predator. It's about a foot and a half long, a cookie cutter shark. It's got a sort of a little eel-like, slug-like body, like a little leech almost, a little swimming leech, and it's got a giant razor-filled mouth, and it darts onto the side of a passing animal and takes a little divot of flesh out, does a little corkscrew spin, and peels away. And in the case of the dolphins, they were down, you know, a couple hundred feet, they were eating the squids, and then they got zapped on the side by this cookie-cutter shark, and it heals typically. It leaves a scar. So I had a picture of a rough-toothed dolphin leaping out of the water with all these little white scars, and that led me to investigate, this is an interesting thing, these cookie cutter sharks. And we learned about them because they were actually eating divots out of submarines in the 1970s. We had neoprene covers on American submarines covering the sonar housing, and they were being attacked by these little sharks that thought it was a big whale,
right,
and messing up the sonar. So then the research discovered the cookie cutter sharks. I just think it's just so fun, and I really want to share with your listeners that this is a great part of nature. Nature doesn't just end at sundown.
Yeah, and I am curious about maybe migratory patterns or what animals might do their migrations under the cloak
birds.
Of night.
Yeah.
The birds, yeah, they're doing all these great migrations, are going for these long lengths. But are there any other creatures that would be surprising that are on the move at night in long distances?
You know, when we think about migration, we immediately think of, you know, the little hummingbird flying up, you know, across the Gulf of Mexico, you know, a little tiny bird flying 500 miles or something. But, you know, migration happens lots of different ways. And there's a species in North America in the West called the mountain quail. And it migrates just by walking. Huh. It typically is up. You know, when the winter comes in, the snow is hitting the high country, they're really not easy to forage for them. And so they want to be a little bit lower elevation. And they walk down the mountain. It may take a month or two to get to the lower elevation. And then they turn around, you know, in spring and walk back up to the higher elevation where they prefer their habitat. So I don't know. It's like migration is so complex and so interesting. It's almost hard for us to think about as humans. All these things going overhead at night that we really don't know about.
Interesting.
Yeah, I mean, literally hundreds of millions of birds are migrating at night.
And bats are migrating at night, too. Of course, we don't really think about that, but there's a bat migration, you know, just as substantial as a bird migration.
Huh.
And some bats, like the Mexican free-tailed bat, that's the one that you see at Carlsbad Caverns or the Congress Avenue Bridge, in Austin, Texas, or the Yolo Bypass in Davis, California, this species, it's a great flyer. It routinely can hunt up at 10,000 feet. It can fly at maximum 100 miles an hour. It's like the peregrine falcon of bats. No, it's not always at that altitude. It's not always zooming along, but it's really capable of some substantial, we think of bats often as sort of a fluttery kind of thing, around your head and, 10 feet off the ground and not really doing much, but some bats can really zoom and boom.
And in the book, you also call out dragonflies and certain dragonflies that migrate at night.
Sure, they are using the subtropical winds, so they're going from India to the Maldives to Africa over multiple generations and going a few months with the trade winds and then finding the monsoon rains have created puddles. They're making new dragonflies that somehow know to go on to the next spot. So it's India to the Maldives to East Africa, then further down in Southern Africa, and then all the way back around following the winds to India again, multiple generations of these dragonflies. And I don't know why the idea of millions of dragonflies crossing the ocean, it just makes me happy. To know hey, there's all the stuff out there. We have such a bad rap as humans. Oh, we've messed up the planet and blah, 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 blah. Yeah, and we have messed up the planet. I won't say that. But we also, at the same time, there's lots of stuff we don't know about. We haven't touched. It's just happening without us.
If you just joined us, we're speaking with naturalist and photographer Charles Hood about his new book, Nature at Night. Discover the hidden world that comes alive after dark. Right, so daylight and nighttime are unchanging and hopefully will never change in their course and frequency. But as you say, according to messing up the planet, the climate is changing, the planet's getting warmer, lots of other components are changing. Is that having an impact in one way or another on animal and biological patterns and lifestyles, let's say?
Well, one assumes that the animals that are going to be affected by heat, for example, are going to have to become a little bit more nocturnal.
Right.
Or, thing is, we don't have a good baseline. So we ask ourselves with coyotes, were coyotes always around at night, or were they more diurnal, 100 years ago, 200 years ago, 300 years ago? And we really don't have good observational data. Mm-hmm. Right now, if I'm a coyote and I'm in Chicago, Salt Lake, Los Angeles, I want to be out at night because that's when the pet food is unattended. That's when the pets are unattended as well. That's when I can get into the rubbish bins. That's when people aren't going to bug me. I can cross the freeway safely.
Right.
So there are going to be lots of, they're incentivized to be nocturnal. But where were those same coyotes, 300 years ago? That we don't know. And so have they become more nocturnal? But I do know that as climate warms, it's going to be just more advantageous to be out at night just because it's cooler. And as people water their lawns, there's, free access to water, or they can go to a swimming pool or something like that. So we're in the middle of some changes that we can't necessarily predict, but I can guarantee they are happening.
Yeah.
And from canines, let's turn into big cats. I was just in Africa not too long ago, and when we were coming in, you're supposed to really be in before dusk, but we were coming in a little bit later, and the dark of night had come, and the sounds, it was like a flip of a switch, and then you heard everything started to come to life, really. These sounds around us, you could hear the lions.
On a full moonlit night, they're at a disadvantage. So for a lion, they have cover of darkness. When it's moonless night is even better. And in fact, I think there's some statistical data that about human attacks are more likely on a moonlit night because of the lions are being less successful in their other kinds of hunting. But just for example, you mentioned, the roaring. If the world is such that it is quieter, there is less traffic, if the humidity is such, it may just be that their voice carries farther at night than it would during the day. And I'm having to do with wind, temperature, humidity, traffic patterns. And I am guessing on this, but I do think there's highly likely some physiological reasons why roaring at night is going to be advantageous. Your sound is going to carry further, or you'll sound fiercer, is my guess. And of course, lions do hunt during the day as well, but it's hot during the day, and things can see you coming. Better to be out in the cool of the evening if you're a lion.
Humans are one of the few species that seems to get the majority of its work done during the day and then takes off the evening.
A lot of the great primates do make nests, orangutans and gorillas and chimpanzees. They bed down for the night.
Right.
But I'll just, again, remind our listeners that we're actually pretty good at night. The problem is we're not allowed to have good night vision. Society kind of conspires against us as individuals. And I'll just give the example that when I get into a modern car, a new car, like the lights all go on, like the dome light is on, and like, well, that's just wrecking my night vision because I actually don't need the lights to get into my own car.
Right.
The steering wheel is exactly where I left it yesterday. The seat is exactly, like I know how to get into my own car. But as soon as the light goes on, I feel perhaps comforted or somehow safe,
right.
But actually I'm more unsafe because now I can't see to drive well without the headlights on or, you know, without, I don't have any peripheral vision left. So society is sort of saying, oh, turn on the security lights, have a Ring camera, you know, have motion detectors. But really, 100 years ago, 200 years ago, 300 years ago, all of our ancestors walked around in the dark perfectly fine. If you worked late in the field and you got back to the village, you had to just walk back by starlight or moonlight. You know, it was quite possible. We don't think it is anymore, but actually humans are pretty good at maneuvering through the nighttime.
Let's get into some of the creatures that maybe glow at night, like your fireflies. Tell us about their physiology.
Well, if you're a firefly, you want to have romance, and so you need to make yourself attractive, and so you know, if having a little blinking light at a certain pattern tells everybody that you're there, which species you are, that you're in good physical shape, that you have enough excess energy to make this. But I'm trying to figure out better, like, why some things are glowing in the dark that don't seem to have an advantage, you know, like obviously a firefly, okay, it's a mating thing, but For your listeners, you know, you could take a UV flashlight and see scorpions fairly easily in the open country in like the desert. But you can also take a UV flashlight and see that some lichen in the middle of the forest glows at night.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't seen any explanations for why that is. And I think there's some room for research there. For those of you in the listening audience who plan to get your PhD soon, I got some ideas. And I want to know, why does a platypus glow in the dark under a UV flashlight?
Huh.
And the reason they know that is they were checking. So some people were checking, some botanists were checking for lichen in the Canadian forest, and they noticed, hey, this squirrel flew by, this nocturnal flying squirrel, it glided by, it glided by, and like, hey, it was glowing, and when it crossed our beam of our UV flashlights that we're using for our lichen studies, the squirrel glowed. Why is that? So they went to, you know, you go to the what they call the pelt vault. Inside a natural history museum, they store the animal pelts. And it turns out platypus glows. So there are a few theories that, like, with the, you know, maybe has to do with uptake of vitamins. If you're out at night, you're not getting as, you know, sunlight, vitamin D. But really, I think which mammals glow in the dark and why is somebody's PhD dissertation waiting to happen. And as soon as one of your listeners gets on that, please contact the station so we can find out ourselves.
Right. That's interesting. Maybe it's a way of attracting another platypus. Maybe it's another dating opportunity.
It might just be a byproduct of some other aspect of how their fur.
Right.
You know, it could be a secondary mechanism that has no advantage or disadvantage. It's merely there in case, you know. So I'm happy to take any answer.
Yes.
But I'm just telling your listeners, a platypus glows in the dark if you have a UV flashlight, and we don't know why.
Interesting.
All right.
Well,
homework.
Someone can figure that out for us, and we'll have them on the show to tell us all about
it. Have you back, too.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Yeah.
The name of the book, again, is Nature at Night, Discover the Hidden World That Comes Alive After Dark. The author is naturalist and photographer Charles Hood. Charles, is there a website that people can go to learn more about your work and your other photography and perhaps other publications?
You're kind to ask. I do have a website, charleshoodbooks.com, and also the book is available through Timber Press on their website or wherever independent books are sold.
And
Thank you.
Photography is absolutely, it's stunning.
And Claire, as a photographer, knows her photography, right, Claire?
I know my way around a camera a little bit, and it's really fascinating and a lot to take a look at here as well as read in your book.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
Well, thank you so much for being on This Green Earth, Charles.
Thanks, Charles.
Okay, thank you.